Coming up on Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway, we review I'll Eat You Last, Pippin, Colin Quinn Unconstitutional, The Memory Show, and On Your Toes at Encores. Please stay tuned. Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, May 19th, 2013. My name is James Marino, and on the broadcast this morning we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his latest being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks, which is coming out May 28th, which is just a mere 9 days from now. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, Masterworks Broadway, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talk in Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many other places on the internet. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Good morning, everybody. So I also wanted to remind everyone that coming up on May 29th, we have a little event at the Drama Bookshop for Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. Come down and see Peter and possibly me and Michael as well, 250 West 40th Street at 5 p.m. So, Peter, getting all geared up for the great book tour?
Well, I'm certainly looking forward to talking with Ken Bloom, the author of Broadway musicals, The 101 Greatest Shows of All Time, when we discuss Tony winners, Tony losers, what should have been, what might have been, what could have been, and a good time, a splendid time is guaranteed for all, as the Beatles used to say. Is that what they used to say?
yes.
Is that the lyric? That show never played Broadway, only the Beacon Theater, otherwise I would have known it. But
well, when Let It Be comes in next year, you know, we'll see. Mm-hmm.
Right, sure, that's right.
Broken by our own Michael Portantier on the podcast.
That's right, yes, indeed.
When who comes in? I'm sorry.
Let it be. You're the show you trumpeted.
Oh, Let It Be. Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. We'll be able to check the lyrics.
Hopefully, they'll get it right. Mm-hmm. All righty. So, April 24th, seemingly almost a month ago, I'll Eat You Last opened up at the Booth Theater. Peter, why don't you start us off with what you thought about the show?
Well, here's Bette Midler playing Sue Mengers, who was a real shark of an agent, no question about it. And John Logan has written a play, so to speak. It's a one-person show. Well, there is a moment where somebody else does come on stage, because Sue Mengers is such an empowered and important person in her own mind that she won't even get off the couch once to go and get something. She calls somebody from the audience to come up and get it, and even take off his shoes before he crosses the room, because she doesn't want her rug to get dirtied by a speck. You know, I would love to play this role, because I would get up there and I would tell her off like crazy, because I just can't stand people like this whatsoever. I have to say that I found in the movie The Last of Sheila, the Sue Mengers imitation by Diane Cannon, to be far more interesting and far more well written by Anthony Perkins and our own Stephen Sondheim in what may very well be the best murder mystery ever. But Sue Mengers is essentially the drawing board character for the one in the movie. So, but nevertheless, Bette Midler is good. I'm surprised she didn't get a Tony nomination. I would love to have been a fly on the wall of that room where this was discussed, because I certainly think that she does everything that she's supposed to do with that delightful smile, as if to say, you know, I'm telling you the truth, and the truth is exactly the way I'm telling it. There could be a little more drama. The drama is the fact that she's having trouble with a few clients now, especially Barbara Streisand. And as a result, she is waiting for a phone call to see if she's still going to be representing Barbara Streisand. I would like to hear more about this conflict that she's had with her, and I would like to see that resolved, but that doesn't quite happen. Nevertheless, Bette Midler is really quite fine. However, when the lights come down, my girlfriend turned to me and said, "That's the end of the first act?" No, that's the show. It's only about 80 minutes long, and it's a little thin under those circumstances. Still, Bette, I wonder if that was, by the way, part of the decision. You know, hey, she's only on stage for 80 minutes. She doesn't even move off the couch. Who knows? But nevertheless, it's certainly an acceptable evening, an enjoyable evening. I chuckled a few times. I never laughed. I guess some of this has to do with the fact that I just do not like people like this, and as a result, I couldn't get emotionally involved with this type of character who is bitching it up and criticizing other people and thinking she's the sun and the moon. Still, Bette Midler does what she set out to do to bring this person to life. Yeah, she does it, and an okay to good evening is what it turned out to be for me.
Michael, what did you think?
Yeah, I agree with Peter for the most part. It was very entertaining. I did think that they might have made more of the Streisand situation, particularly. I think that the evening would have benefited from having a little bit more drama. As it is, it seems to me there's only maybe one or two moments near the end where she gets... where Mangers becomes sort of wistful and sad and thinking that maybe her career is ending and just having regrets about certain things. Because the comedy part of it was really quite wonderful, and she did a great job of it. I will say that I could never forget it was Bette Midler. And the specific reason was it seems to me from what I know and from the clips I've seen and that she is the same general type as Sue Mangers. So she's well cast in that way. The thing that kept screaming out at me is that Bette Midler does tend to have very, very noticeable and specific vocal quirks that she uses for comedy purposes. And she did, in fact, use them again here. It's a little hard for me to do it, but she does something, for example, where she'll say something like, you haven't seen the film. And she'll say, well, you haven't seen the film. She like kind of hyper-articulates like that and puts these little pauses in between, mm-hmm. Not pauses, just these little like glottal attacks, mm-hmm. almost. Yeah, sure. And I associate that so much with her and only with her that every time she did that, it was no longer Sue Mangers, it was Bette Midler. That was a little bit of a problem for me as far as actually giving myself over to her believing that she was the character. But other than that, it really was very, very entertaining and very interesting to anyone who, I guess, even has a passing knowledge of Hollywood and agencies such as William Morris, which is now William Morris Endeavor and Creative Artists Agency. And there was a lot of name dropping, but done in a very entertaining way, I thought. And certainly... several stories, which presumably are true. There's no reason to think that there aren't. But yes, overall, I really enjoyed it. I like John Logan as a writer, and he's done several very different types of things. That impresses me. I think he did a very good job. It goes without saying, I think, that it's not easy to write a one-person show. first of all, you have to establish the convention of exactly how the person starts talking to the audience and then how they sustain it. You know, are there going to be a lot of phone calls or not? Things like that. But I thought it was very well done and well directed by Joe Mantello. And yes, as I say, it's great to see Bette Midler back on Broadway. I've certainly never seen her on Broadway. I've seen her at Radio City in concert and maybe in a couple of other places. But she hasn't been on Broadway since Fiddler on the Roof. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
not even in a one. I don't think any of her one-person shows were on Broadway, were they?
No, there were a few. Yeah, that Clams in the Half Shell Review, I think, played the Palace.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah,
but there again, that's years and years ago.
Yeah, and maybe a show at the Minskoff too rings a bell. But nevertheless, yeah, in terms of playing a role, yeah, playing one of the daughters in Fiddler, when Adrienne Barbeau was in it too.
Oh, the same cast.
Yeah, wow. Both of them were in it. Yeah, wow. So.
Yeah, so I would highly recommend it as a very entertaining evening.
All right, so let's move on to the last show of the season, which of course was Pippin. They snuck it in under the wire there, playing at the Music Box. Opened on April 25th. Peter, why don't you start us off with Pippin?
Fine. Pippin gets a lot of heat for not having a good book, and I don't understand that at all. I think Pippin has a wonderful book, because this is the story of a young man who is trying to find himself. And I think Roger O'Herson did a splendid job in showing us that he thought that going to war was the way to go, and perhaps finding women and sleeping his way with women through life was the way to go, and politics was the way to go, and all that goes with that. I think this is all set up very, very nicely before he stumbles into a relationship with a woman with a child and discovers that being an important person to a woman and a young man, a young boy, is a wonderful way to spend your life, to make two people happy, to really see them fulfilled, to make them have a better life than they would have had without you, is a wonderful and terrific achievement. And I think that's one of the great strengths of Pippin. And I don't think Roger O'Herson ever gets credit for that, and I don't understand why. I mean, really, it's funny. I mean, this is the theme of Avenue Q just many years earlier, 30 years earlier, because, of course, Pippin is trying to find his purpose. And he does stumble into it, but it turns out to be something that is very rewarding. Okay. The thing that people have always loved about Pippin is both the score and the Bob Fosse staging. You don't quite get the Bob Fosse staging here. In a way, the production looks a little bus and truck, too, because it's very much scaled down from that wonderful production from 1972, which was amazing. I mean, that was the year that Little Night Music won the Tony Award, but Bob Fosse won for direction. One of the few times that Harold Prince directed a Steve Sondheim show and didn't come back with a Tony. So this was really quite a staging by Bob Fosse. And while Diane Paulus doesn't quite replicate that, and it isn't on the scale of the original, this is solid direction, and it does have its own type of excitement because it has a lot of acrobatics, even down to Andrea Martin. Everybody talks about how wonderful Andrea Martin is in delivering that wonderful song about seizing life when you can, because it doesn't last that long, no time at all, it goes by. Andrea Martin has a few acrobatic tricks that are truly stunning and certainly something I wasn't expecting to see. So to me, Pippin is always welcome, and this is a solid revival, even if it looks like it's done a bit on the cheap. I like Bettina Miller quite a bit as the leading player. It's a controversial performance. A lot of people have felt that she may be a little too glitzy and what have you. And, of course, the memory of Ben Vereen is not an easy one to erase. The show that made him a star and got him a Tony Award way back when. The other controversial performance in it, by the way, is the woman who plays Catherine, the woman with whom Pippin reluctantly falls in love, Rachel Baye Jones. I thought she was terrific. I enjoyed her quirkiness quite a bit, though not everybody feels that way. Terrence Mann, quite wonderful, and his longtime love, Charlotte D'Amboise, playing Charlemagne and Fastrada, his current love, and Eric Altemus, an actor I've seen at CCM, does a terrific job as Louis, her son, who she has wonderful big plans for. So really, this is a nice production. Those of us who saw the original, of course, will never see it bettered. But nevertheless, having Pippin on Broadway is a wonderful thing. It's a show that speaks to young people tremendously. And I look forward to speaking to people of all ages for many, many months and maybe even years to come.
All right. Michael, what did you think about Pippin?
I ran into an actor friend of mine the other day, and we were talking about it, and he said, did you see Pippin? And I said, yes, I did. What did you think of it? And he said, I thought it was the greatest revival of a show I've ever seen in my life.
Mm.
And I could not really argue with him. I think it's absolutely fantastic. The audience response is through the roof. You can just feel people sitting there absolutely loving it. I thought it was brilliantly directed. I thought that the acrobatics and the other circus apparatus did not in any way distract or detract from the music and the book. I thought they only added to it. I thought the cast is beyond amazing. I was delighted that it seemed to me that the orchestrations were pretty much untouched, except maybe little enhancements and little changes here and there, and some key changes because, as Peter mentioned, the leading player is now being played by a woman. But I love those original orchestrations, and I thought they sounded phenomenal again. I never saw the original production live. There is, as many of us know, a video of a touring production. So that gives a really, obviously, quite a good idea of what Fosse originally wrought. But you got to see this show live, I'll tell you. Got so many points to make. By the way, watching that video, I was surprised to hear suddenly new lyrics to the song With You. And I know that Stephen Schwartz is famous for rewriting lyrics, his own lyrics. Sometimes with apparently no reason. in this case, I'm not sure what he felt was wrong with the original. But at any rate, that video is the only time I've ever heard these other lyrics. I don't think I've ever heard them in any other stage production, and I've seen quite a few. So that surprised me. I didn't even know about that, and maybe he just had it as a second thought and then changed his mind back. As I think I mentioned last week when Peter brought it up, it never occurred to me to say that this production looks cheap or less than elaborate in any way, because although the actual physical sets are quite limited, I mean, it seems appropriate. You have what looks like it's supposed to be a big top, circus tent, and then things are brought on within it, but there's so much going on in terms of props and costumes and lights and effects and magical tricks that it just really never entered my mind to say that it looks cheap. And I don't think I don't think it looks like a cheap show in general, just in terms of the cast size and the things, the apparatus that they use. And I'm wondering if I don't really know the details on things like this, but I'm wondering if there's extra expenses for insurance, because some of the things that are done on stage look quite potentially, dangerous, and that definitely adds to the thrill too. As far as the book, I think I may also have said this last week. Yeah, Peter, I think the book is fine. I think maybe some people don't object to the general theme and the general thrust and the arc of it and the way it's constructed, but some of the individual lines can sound a little sophomoric, I guess, depending on the way they're delivered. But maybe that's not a negative thing either. I mean, it's kind of the style of the show, which is obviously very, very presentational in many ways. And as far as the theme, you mentioned What was the other show you mentioned that
Avenue Q?
Yeah. Well, you know, one could say, I was just thinking off the top of my head, one could say the same thing, In the Heights, Green Willow, and how about Allegro? I mean, those are all basically about someone feeling that maybe they should get out in the world and, like, you know, and make something of themselves in the larger world, and not necessarily stay in the loving community that they inhabit. And then ultimately, they all decide to stay. So I guess that that's a theme that really has resonated with several musical theater writers. And here again, it's done well. As for the ending, as I'm sure many of you know, it has been changed. There is a basic change that happened several years ago based on, I believe, a production that Stephen Schwartz saw somewhere and really liked what they did with the ending. And since then, he has incorporated it into the actual script. It does not bother me. To me, it still makes the same point that the original made, and then just takes it one little step further. So I don't mind it at all. I know our friend John Rubinstein, whom we had as a guest a couple of weeks ago, said, based on a previous production he had seen, that he didn't love the new ending. But I think it's fine. I think it's very truthful too. And then just quickly, I'm surprised to hear you say that about Rachel May Jones, Peter. I mean, I suppose every performance that everyone gives in anything is controversial to the extent that somebody doesn't like it. But as far as I've heard, everyone I know adores her.
Oh, that's good. I'm glad to hear.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. She really just brings, and I think she improves the, I mean, I got the impression that she improves the writing in the second act. Now, but there again, one can say, well, maybe she's just doing it right, you know? So maybe she is showing us that the book is better than some people thought it was. And that's always nice when that happens, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Charlotte d'Amboise, I thought, looked hotter and sexier than I have ever seen her in anything. Just, I don't know, a combination of the wig or hairstyle that she had and the costume. She was really, really on fire on stage. Terrence Mann, I had actually seen play Charlemagne before in a one-night concert benefit of Pippin that was done a few years ago with Michael Arden as Pippin. And that production had a rotating leading players, including Rosie O'Donnell and Darius De Haas, and several women and men. And then at the very end of that show, Ben Vereen came on and did the last scene, which was where you can imagine the audience.
Sure.
It was just beyond. It was beyond. I liked. Oh, I attended. The first time I attended this Pippin, Patina Miller was out, as I may have mentioned. I guess she just got sick, and apparently she is not known to miss at all. She certainly didn't have that reputation during Sister Act. So it just, you know, she just got sick, and on very short notice, we got to see Stephanie Pope do a wonderful job as the leading player. But then we were invited back to see Patina, because she does have lots of nominations, and she was also excellent in a different way. I think the age difference between those two performers made quite a significant difference in the effect, you know, the relationships, the relationship to Pippin specifically. So that was fun to see. And speaking of Pippin, Matthew James Thomas really, really won me over. He has a voice. It's weird. I think maybe he just could use a rest that I'm sure he's not going to get. Sometimes his voice sounds very raspy. But then, like, the next second he'll hit, you know, a high F and it'll sound absolutely perfect and beautiful. So I'm not sure what's going on with that. Acting wise, he was I thought he was ideal. He does, by the way, what sounds to me like a flawless American accent, to the point where I'm sure many, many people won't even occur to them that he's British. But he is. And he added a few, acting wise, you know, I thought he was really extraordinary, especially at the end with Pippin's struggle as to whether or not to basically kill himself in a spectacular fashion. And that's going to be his, you know, his big swan song to the world. It, you know, when you see that now, especially with what's been going on lately, I couldn't help thinking of people who, you know, commit these horrible murders, you know, almost as like, well, it's this insignificant person that tragically tries to, you know, make themselves add their names to history by doing something foolish or horrible. And fortunately, Pippin chooses not to. But Matthew James Thomas gave a really wonderful account of that moment, and the way that is staged, I'm not going to spoil it, but it's nail biting, I would say. You've got to see it. I would give this the highest marks possible, this production. And you know, I've been saying to several people, I have a feeling it might run for years, because it seems to me it would appeal to so many different types of audiences of all ages. You know, if you're not especially a musical theater person, you're going to love the acrobatics and the tumbling and the fire and all that stuff. You know, it's got a love story, but it's, you know, it's also, I think, obviously a show that young people would respond to very much because of the theme. I can't think any who wouldn't like it. I expect it to see it. I hope to see it at the Music Box for many, many years.
All right. So it does have a lot of positive buzz around the neighborhood, and we'll have to see what happens in the next few weeks about that, because it's being mentioned as a very strong contender.
Oh, Peter, you know, what surprised me, nobody laughed when Andrea Martin sang "You Could Squander Away or Sequester." I just kind of thought that word might get a laugh because it's been in the news so much lately. I mean, maybe a few months ago it would have gotten a bigger laugh, because that's not a word you hear every day. But I didn't.
You know, for that matter, God knows Steve Schwartz was looking for a rhyme at one point, but he says that sages tweet. And back in 1972, all he meant was sages say.
Oh, right, right.
You need the lines. But of course, today tweeting has a very different meaning. And it's so funny to hear that word used when, of course, we had no idea back in 1972 what that would come to mean in the 21st century. So I didn't even think of the sequester thing. That's a very good point.
Well, yeah. And it's so delightful when something like that happens.
Sure.
You know.
Sure.
All right. So moving on, just want to remind folks that coming up on Monday, June 3rd, 2013, at 6:45 p.m. at the Music Box Theater, there's some little party going on. Peter, isn't there?
Yeah, we're doing the Theater World Awards. We look forward to giving out 12 prizes to 6 men, actually 13 now that I think of it, to 7 men and 6 women, because we also give out a Dorothy Loudon Award to a performance that we believe, a committee believes that Dorothy would have liked and approved of. So we'll be doing that at the Music Box, and I'm certainly looking forward to that. That's always a highlight of my year to MC the ceremony. So we'll look forward to that. And I think we might have some nice celebrities up there presenting to this year's winners. We always use people who have won Theatre World Awards before. So that's the criterion. In fact, it was terrible a few years ago when A Moon for the Misbegotten was on and Kevin Spacey grandly said, I'll present to Eva Best. I'll do it. Yes, indeed. Sign me up. And he hadn't won. We had to say, Kevin, the rules are, you have to win these prizes. Yeah, and it was terrible. This was really a case of our thinking, should we bend the rules? Should we break the rules that have been in place since 1945 when the award started, because nobody had won before to present, but nevertheless, you get my point. And it was a big decision to make, and we did say, Mr. Spacey, we have to say no, so it's always previous winners. So we're looking forward to seeing many of the previous Theatre World Award winners giving to the new Theatre World Award winnings, and it'll be nice that we'll be on the stage of the Music Box. I always like when we do it at a Broadway theater. Last year it was at the Belasco. We've done it at the August Wilson. We've done it at the Helen Hayes. So I certainly like the idea I'm going to be playing yet another Broadway theater. I enjoy that.
Excellent. You couldn't give Kevin Spacey a quick Theatre World Award right before?
I guess we couldn't. It's so full of integrity, aren't we?
We'll have none of that.
Yeah, right.
All right. Also, I think both of you saw Colin Quinn at Unconstitutional at Barrow Street, or just Michael? Just Michael. So, Michael, you saw Colin Quinn. Tell us about Unconstitutional.
Oh, yeah. I don't have much to say except that it was hilarious. I had seen Mr. Quinn do his Broadway show a few years ago, and while it was thoroughly enjoyable, it seemed like in that case it wasn't so much laugh out loud funny. It was more clever and humorous. This one, people were like just rolling in the aisles. Ooh. He has a wonderful way of delivery. He talks very fast in a very I would say very pronounced New York accent, and he just seems like this regular guy, just like going on and like ranting about various stuff. The subject matter here was, as you might guess from the title, Colin Quinn Unconstitutional. It was about politics in general and all various hot button issues that are all being discussed now. And an interesting thing is it's at the Barrow Street Theater, and he performs it on the set of the last show that was there, Hit the Wall, which was about the Stonewall riots. And it kind of surprised me because, obviously they have to take the set down at some point, but I guess maybe they didn't have time to do it now and he wanted to do his show. And, his show doesn't require any kind of a set, so he just chose to do it on that set. And it didn't matter. It was great. So he's still performing basically in the... Well, not quite in the round. I guess the audience is on three sides. He really works the crowd and just talks about everything from immigration to free speech and blah, blah, blah. And I guess I can quote the last line because it made such an impression on me. It's so typical of his humor. He was talking about immigration and all the controversies and various things about people trying to stem it or stop it or obstruct it, and other people fighting to have more access and blah blah blah. And he talked about why so many people still want to come to the country. And he gave the history of that and what it was like in decades past. And then he talks about how much the world and the country have changed. And he says something like, and now all these people, all these immigrants come here and they get here and they go, where's the party? And we say, you missed it. And that was the last lie. And there's so much truth in that little thing, the two-line phrase that he gave. It's in a way it's not funny, but I just found it so very true, and that's the kind of humor he does. A lot of truth in his humor, which I think maybe is the the most lasting kind of humor, and
oh yeah, nothing better.
Yeah, so I was really very, very impressed with him, and it's not a long run at all, but try to get there if you can.
So tell me, is it in comparison to like, is it stand up or is it a show or is it kind of, what is it?
It's completely stand up, I would say. There's no there's no other person. He's not playing characters. He's just talking.
All right.
Did you see his last show, Peter?
Yeah, that was Long Story Short, right?
I don't remember what the subtitle was.
It was at the Helen Hayes.
Yeah, very similar. You know.
Yeah.
But as I said, this one, for some reason, I mean, I wonder if he like intentionally did that. Maybe it was the uptown audience as opposed to the downtown. I mean, people were really just loving this show. There's so much, almost constant laughter. It was really fantastic.
Yeah, that was not the case with Long Story Short.
No, it wasn't. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm not even certain it was meant to be, but
that's my question.
Mm. So well, good. That's wonderful that he's getting all these laughs. How terrific!
Yeah.
All right. I was looking to see here who produced this. It seems like it's Barrow Street, but is it Barrow Street that produced it? Well, it doesn't really matter. All right. So the Memory Show down at the Duke, which is part of the produced by the Transport Group. Peter saw that. Why don't you tell us about it, Peter?
Yeah, Catherine Cox, a terrific musical theater actress. Even, I believe, a Tony nominee for Shakespeare's Cabaret many moons ago. Time has passed, and she's an older woman now, though she looks terrific. In a way, she may even be looking too terrific for this part because she's playing a woman who has Alzheimer's. And another terrific musical theater actress comes to tend to her. There is an issue that the mother always brings up, that the daughter has come to her because she's not doing well in life and she needs to save on her rent. And Leslie Kritzer's character denies this to a certain degree. And we never really know if that's really true, if the girl needs the mother as much as the mother needs the daughter. So this was written by a woman named Sarah Cooper, I believe, and I don't have the playbill in front of me. I think that was her name. And I get the impression that this is something she went through with her mother, and she wrote about it. And she did a very good job writing about it. She hits all the points that one would expect to see about the mother contradicting herself a second after saying something, about not remembering things, about continually getting worse, all that goes with that, and dealing with it. Now, it's very effective. It is solid. It is writing of a very high quality and all that. And to be blunt, I'm not happy about this, but I have to say I don't know why people would want to see such a show. As quality filled as it is, it's 90 minutes, no intermission, and it was hard for me to watch this. And I imagine it was hard for many in the audience to watch it. There's very little humor in it. I'm not criticizing it for that. But the audience was amazingly silent during the show. There were very few points where you heard even a chuckle. There were some, but there were very few. And I had no idea how the audience was taking to this show. I will admit, at the end of the show, the audience gave it quite an ovation. They seemed to be very appreciative of it. I have a feeling that this has more to do with the fact that both Catherine Cox and Leslie Kritzer are terrific in it. But nevertheless, it's a show that you really appreciate rather than one you enjoy. By the time this podcast runs, it will have closed. It's closing as we do this on Sunday. It is closing today. And I can't imagine much of a future life for this show, quality filled as it is, because it just is no fun at all.
Oh, well, I can appreciate that, but you have some incredible talents on the stage there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
What's the name of Leslie's show that she's doing around? It's she's doing it at Joe's Pub, isn't she? What's
She's certainly been there with the Patti LuPone show. I didn't know she was doing another one. So a terrific performer, really. I first noticed her at Cincinnati Conservatory of Music in Babes in Arms, where she played Baby Rose, and she was I can still see her on stage making her entrance and really packing a wall up and doing so. Also, she was a tremendous Fanny Bryce and Funny Girl at Paper Mill maybe about 10 years ago. And,
yes.
And, you know, was considered for the revival, and one has to wonder if the revival would have happened if she would have done it. I would have done it sound like she turned it down, that she wouldn't deign to do it. That isn't what happened.
No, but, not quite.
But nevertheless, it might have been a very different story had she been allowed to do it. Maybe it would have got on and been very successful.
The show is called Leslie Kritz, Her Beautiful Disaster.
Huh.
That she does down. She's doing down at Joe's Pub, and it's a lot of buzz, and people are raving about it.
Good for
so,
her.
Yeah. So it's she's very, very talented.
Mm.
All right. So next up, we are going to talk about On Your Toes at Encores. So Michael, why don't you start us off with that?
I thought it was a terrific presentation of a show that I was lucky enough to see the stellar Broadway revival. Back in, help me, Peter.
83.
At which time, tremendous effort and money presumably was spent to restore the show, basically in terms of the orchestrations and et cetera, and try to recreate the original Balanchine choreography. And this is probably, I would say, the heaviest, if not one of the heaviest dance shows that Encores has ever done. And they got Warren Carlyle to direct and choreograph. And he did a really excellent job of, this is a show that by its very nature, it's about, it has a lot of ballet in it, but it also has a lot of tap and jazz style dancing. So it really runs the gamut. When you see this show, you feel like you've really got your money's worth in terms of dancing. That's for sure. But not only that, you get beautiful, wonderful Rodgers and Hart songs like "Glad to Be Unhappy" and. I don't have the list in front of me. It's just. I'm sorry. Here it is now. There's a small hotel. I'm sure I would say the biggest hit to come out of it, and the title song, although maybe not so famous, is really delightful. And then lesser known comic songs like "Too Good for the Average Man" with some really great. Lawrence Hart lyrics. Did I mention "Glad to Be Unhappy"?
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful, beautiful song. And a choral number called "Quiet Night" that's absolutely gorgeous. Just the arrangement of it and the melody. It's a very simple melody, but it's just so beautiful. And the show is fascinating. I did not actually know until I actually interviewed Sean Wiley for Broadway Stars, and he was the first one that mentioned that it was originally the property was worked up as a project for Fred Astaire to do on film. And the story was that Astaire decided not to because he was establishing establishing his persona in the movies, and this role of Junior Dolan would not have permitted him to wear his famous white tie and tails, and that's why he turned it down. Now, who knows? That sounds a little apocryphal, but for whatever reason, Astaire did not do the film, and then the property was brought to Broadway, in which it starred Ray Bolger in the role that Astaire was to have played. And therein lies a very interesting point, because one of the main questions is how that central role of Junior Dolan should be played? Should he be a character man like Ray Bolger, a rubber-limbed character man? Should he be a more suave, debonair guy like Fred Astaire, or should he be he really kind of has to be a combination of the two, because the part contains both elements. There's definite comedy in it. There's a ballet in the first act that Junior winds up in on short notice and screws it up almost like, you know, he's Lucy Ricardo, one of those scenes that we've seen many times. But then there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of actual romance and romantic singing and dancing and other types of comedy and a lot of tap. So I thought that actually Sean did a great job, and the rest of the cast was very strong. Christine Baranski as Peggy Porterfield, and Walter Bobby in a really, really charming turn as the Russian impresario. And let's see, we had the two ballet people whom I do not know, only because I don't go to the ballet, but anyone who does, I'm sure will know these people. Irina Dvorovenko and Joaquin Deluz. They were the two Russian prima ballerina and primo ballerino or whatever word that is. And they're having a tempestuous relationship on and off the stage that really adds to the comedy. And she, and I have to say, Irina Dvorovenko in particular, had a wonderful, really, really excellent way with a comic line. This part won a Tony Award for Natalia Makarova in 83?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I can't keep that date in my head. And here again, the comedy was really, really nailed by Irina. It's the lines are very funny, and she just did a great job with it. Randy Skinner and Karen Ziemba, it was great to see them basically in one number right at the beginning, playing Phil's Junior's parents in a terrific charm number called Two a Day for Keith, which is about the vaudeville circuit, really. And it mentions several vaudeville circuits, Keith, Orpheum, Lowe. These are things that are kind of receding into the mists of history, but it's nice to hear those names brought back again. And Dalton Harrod, who is 16, did a fantastic little turn in that number too, as young Junior or young Phil. So overall, it was really, really a wonderful, wonderful presentation, and always a pleasure to hear those Hans Spialik orchestrations again. The cast album of the revival, the 83 revival, was, I believe, one of the first cast albums to be digitally recorded. I remember much was made of that at the time, and thank God, because it just sounds so clear and so beautiful. You almost feel like you're sitting in the middle of the orchestra. So I'm glad that is a record of these orchestrations. Who knows if they'll record the Encores version? I suspect maybe not. But anyway, overall, the Encores presentation was a delight, and I think it's the perfect type of show for them, even though some people said, well, you know, gosh, we had that great revival and they really worked on it then and really restored the show then. But that was already a long time ago. So
this is what people should really realize. Everybody who sees something always says, gee, that was just here, you know, and it wasn't. A lot of people have come along in 30 years who have become interested in the Broadway musical. It's fine to give them a chance to see a show that we've already seen. You know, it's perfectly fine. I agree with everything Michael says to the nth degree, except I don't like this musical at all because I think it's utterly ridiculous with its book.
Oh.
One of the things that happens in it is the fact that gangsters show up and they get tangentially involved in the plot. the real problem for me is that the impresario, as Michael says, wonderfully played by Walter Bobby, his accent was consistent throughout, he chooses Junior to be in the new ballet Slaughter on 10th Avenue, and he doesn't choose his primo ballerino, Constantine. So Constantine, so angry that he has chosen a mere teacher. Yes, there is a feeling of those who can do, those who can't teach. that he's chosen this teacher, that he pays $5,000 to a hitman to kill Junior while he's dancing. Now, he's that angry he didn't get the part? I mean, he's going to – that is ridiculous to me. So anyway, the feeling is that the ballet concludes with Junior's falling to the floor. That's part of the ballet. The audience is going to clap wildly and cheer, and because the audience is going to be cheering so loudly, the murderer can shoot and kill, and nobody will actually hear that a bullet has gone off. You know, and so I mean, that seems absurd to me. Well, anyway, what's even more absurd is the stage doorman overhears the plot. So during the number, he comes out and he actually gives Junior a note to read. And would he really stop what he's doing and read this note mid-number? I mean, that's odd to me too. But he does, and he realizes that if he keeps dancing and doesn't drop to the floor, maybe the police will have enough time to come in and arrest the hitman. I mean, this is so bizarre to me. And by the way, it was a big florent for encores because encores, of course, has the orchestra on stage behind the performers. Now, remember, this is a situation where the dancer is going to keep dancing, so he has to cue the conductor, play that over again. And why the conductor would, or why he doesn't question it and just keeps on going, is, of course, another issue. But still, in the original and in that 83 revival, and there was even a 54 revival that didn't do well at all, the junior could look right into the orchestra pit and gesture to the conductor, keep playing. But here, it encores with the orchestra behind. It's very hard for him to turn around and face that guy. And why would the conductor turn around and look at him to get the cue to keep playing? So it was very, very strange. And that wasn't worked out well at all. But it's an impossible plot. And I guess, you know, the end justifies the means and that we do get to see Slaughter on 10th Avenue. And perhaps even more importantly, hear Slaughter on 10th Avenue. Wow, did Richard Rodgers stretch himself here, huh? I mean, this is an amazing piece. Also, Rodgers must have been very thrilled to be able to write something where he didn't have to depend on Hart, who was notoriously lazy and notoriously irresponsible, Rodgers almost had to chain him to a desk to get him to write anything. At one point when Hart was in the hospital, I think this was with By Jupiter, their final show together, he actually went to the hospital and made him write there. But anyway, so Rodgers must have enjoyed writing a piece of music that he knew he didn't have to wait for lyrics on. I just find the show ludicrous in many instances. Yes. I mean, after all, this is a pre-Oklahoma show, about by 7 years, so we have to cut it some slack and look at the glasses half full, I guess, because it was an ambitious show. It did bring in dance in a way that hadn't been done to this degree before. To have two ballets really be part of the show, important parts of the show, not just thrown in because it's time for a dance, is certainly commendable as well. But I only wish, you know, that Rodgers and Hart and George Abbott could have come up with something a little better than if he stops dancing, he's going to be killed by a hitman who shouldn't have been hired in the first place.
Well, I'd like to say, of course, Peter, that's absolutely ridiculous. And it's funny, I had completely forgotten that plot point until I saw this production again. But also, you know what? You know what it reminds me of? The Man Who Knew Too Much.
Ah.
And I just looked it up. I mean, most of us know The Man Who Knew Too Much, I think, from the remake with Doris Day from the 50s.
Yeah.
But the original was 1934, 2 years before On Your Toes. And in and there again, in The Man Who Knew Too Much, what does it say here? Let me just read this. The group intends to assassinate the head of state of an unidentified European country during a concert at the Royal Albert Hall. And that's pretty much what happens here. The assassin is told that, you know, there's going to be this big musical climax, and, you know, he can shoot at the end and the audience won't hear it. And it's really exactly the same thing. So I wonder, is that a coincidence, or did they just kind of borrow it from The Man Who, from Hitchcock, you know?
Very good point.
Yeah.
Never occurred to me before.
Yeah.
You know, I did see that original Man Who Knew Too Much back in the 70s before I knew On Your Toes as a stage piece. Of course, I knew On Your Toes as one of the Lehman Engel recordings that was made on Columbia during the 50s when they were sort of retroactively making cast albums, so to speak, by recording shows that hadn't gone recorded because they were too early for the revolution that happened with Oklahoma. So that never occurred to me, but you're absolutely right. It is the same thing, isn't it?
Pretty close.
Yep.
Well, we had our own version of The Men Who Knew Too Much this week with Michael Feingold and Michael Musto are out at the Village Voice. I wonder if the new owners of the Village Voice would send them to a concert and try to take them out in that direction.
Wow. What a bizarre thing.
Yeah.
It's like an institution. I'll admit I'm theatric-centric, but nevertheless, those were the first two things I went to in that,
in
that newspaper. I mean, and sure, I mean, the rest of the paper was fun to read and what have you. But
and even if they weren't the first two things you read to, the third thing that I went to was Dan Savage, and he's
absolutely
gone too.
Absolutely. Just going to bring that up. And he left, they stopped putting him in 2 months ago.
Yeah.
Yes,
well, I think Savage is more syndicated than, right? He wasn't a staffer like Feingold.
Right. Yeah, no question about that. But nevertheless, I would have never imagined that this was even possible. Michael was there like a third. Michael Feingold was there something like a third of a century.
Yeah.
This is really, really amazingly surprising and tragic for both of them too. Michael Musto is a great writer. Does his job extraordinarily well with Gossip, and I'm flabbergasted that this came to this, and I can't imagine why anybody at the Village Voice would think that this is an improvement.
Well, we all know that publications like that are hurting greatly, but I guess we don't pull the strings. We don't. We're not in a position to obviously make the decisions. One could only wish that they had found some other area to make cutbacks in, because as someone else pointed out, it's become such a catch-22 situation, or a is that the right word, or just like a circular descent, because whatever revenue drops and readership drops, ad revenue drops, and then they get rid of great writers like Michael Feingold and Michael Musto, and then readership drops further and ad revenue drops further, and it just keeps going. I can't say that I'm smart enough to know how to solve it and stem the tide, but one might have hoped that there was something else that could have been done.
Well, for one thing, what could have been done is the fact that given that they're saying, Michael, you can freelance with us, you're not on staff anymore, but we will take your reviews on a freelance basis. Why fire? I mean, why did anybody have to know that it had to be a firing and this strange type of rehiring on a freelance basis? Oh. Why not let everything go along and say, Michael, we just can't afford to pay you a staff salary anymore. We will pay you on a case-by-case basis. But why firing? I mean, that's so dramatic, and it certainly makes a statement that they don't appreciate him nearly enough. That didn't have to happen. It could have been done much more quietly. And if Michael had wanted to go public with it, that's another story, I'll grant you.
Right.
But still, it's no surprise that newspapers are doing terribly and will continue to do terribly. But still firing? I mean, there's such a negative thing applied to that.
Well, let me jump in for a few different points here in that what's going to happen with the Obie Awards. A lot of people have said we should, folks should boycott the Obie Awards, and not to mention the firing of Feingold, and he hosts the Obie Awards, which are the Village Voice Awards. So it's a very strange thing that's happening there. And there's this guy out in Omaha, Nebraska. His name is Warren Buffett. I don't know if anybody's heard of him, but he's one of the wealthiest men in the world, and he's a very astute businessman. And in the last 15 months, he's bought 28 newspapers. And he feels like newspapers are mismanaged and misrun, and that they are great developers of community and profit. And perhaps that this is just... The Village Voice is just the latest in a... Buffett hasn't said this. I'm saying that perhaps the Village Voice is just not being managed to its potential. I think that I read somewhere that the owners of the Village Voice are in Phoenix.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
That sounds right, yeah.
I wonder if somebody who is more local could run this a little bit better and get it back on its feet, although... It's very, very hard for media properties to have a resurgence. Once they go down, the next big thing comes up. So maybe we will find another new independent weekly newspaper in New York.
This sounds like a non sequitur, but some years ago at the Manhattan Theater Club, Paul Rudnick wrote a play called Regrets Only. And the concept of the play was, what would happen if the gay people disappeared overnight? And how would our society be impacted? And Christine Baranski showed up having her hair looking terrible because there are no hairdressers, that type of thing. When I saw this play, the first thing I thought of was Michael Feingold will mention in his review that this concept was originally in a play called Day of Absence, which was about what would happen if black people disappeared overnight. I mean, that it was the same story, just with... a different group. And it was funny that was my thought, that Michael Feingold would put this in his review, that he would know and remember this play from the early 60s, which had fallen into obscurity. Thank God we didn't really need it anymore as time was going on to make its point. But nevertheless, it was funny that that's what occurred to me, that he would be the one. Why didn't I think of other critics?
Because that's exactly what he does. He has a terrific breadth and depth of knowledge.
No question. And his sense of history is amazing.
Yeah, and I can't think of anyone else who writes the type of reviews that he writes in any kind of a mainstream publication.
And by the way, when I read the review of Dave's of Absence of the Village Voice, of Regrets Only, yes, he did.
There it was.
He did. I knew he would, and he did.
So we'll have to see how this shakes up over the next few months.
Well, you mentioned in passing, James, maybe the absolute weirdest thing about it is, why didn't they wait till after the Obies?
Yes. That's corporations do things on 13-week cycles, basically surrounded around their quarterly reports for investors. And I'm imagining that if you asked somebody at this Phoenix Corporation to describe the Obies, they might not know what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. So what's coming up this week for you guys? Anything special?
I'm going to Rochester, New York, to judge a contest, which I did last year as well. And this is for the teenagers who are going to hope that they can come to New York and be part of the Jimmy Awards that are done in June.
Oh.
So about last year was about 15 boys, 15 girls, and we choose one of each to come to New York and be part of the Jimmy. So I'll be in Rochester this week. I'm also going to see the Caucasian Chalk Circle. I'm looking forward to that on Wednesday. It's a play I like very, very much. And CSC, which does wonderful work virtually all the time, is doing that. So I'm certainly looking forward to that.
We haven't talked about the CSC's passion, the recording, and what's happened there.
Oh,
Mike,
yeah.
You want to talk about
that's
that
regrettable.
A little bit?
Poor Melissa Erica, really going through hard times.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have the details in front of me, but she, I guess initially they thought, or it was bronchitis that kept her out of the show for weeks, and now it turns out she's going to actually have vocal surgery.
Yeah.
Didn't it say she was going to Europe for it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, gosh.
So they kept on pushing back the recording of Passion, the CSC production of Passion. They were making a recording of it, a cast recording, and it turns out that Melissa's not going to be able to sing the role in the recording anyway.
Yeah, but Rebecca Luker is a wonderful substitute.
Oh, absolutely.
There's no question about that. But still, you want it to be the cast that you saw, you know, or the cast that was, even if you didn't see it. So nothing against Rebecca Luker, who was easily one of our greatest musical theater stars, but render to Errico the things that are Errico, you know, so it's too bad.
And she, and it's not like Melissa performs constantly. So that made it all the more disappointing. She really was terrific in this show, and I'm glad that I saw it at the beginning. She was great, you know.
Yeah,
Because her understudy had to come in and do quite a few of them.
So Peter's heading up to Rochester. What are you doing, Michael?
Well, I hope some of our listeners hear this in time. Monday evening, May 20th, is the 7th annual Broadway Beauty Pageant, which is for male members of ensemble casts of Broadway shows. And other than the fact that they're male, it's a traditional beauty pageant with interview and talent and swimsuit competitions. It's really been building over the past several years. It's a benefit for the Ali Forney Center, which is one of the most wonderful causes you could imagine. They provide shelter for homeless gay and lesbian, bisexual teens who have been thrown out of their homes, you know, shunned by their families. So what could be more wonderful than that? And by the way, they had been having, you know, of course, it's always a struggle to keep going, an organization like that to keep going. And they had been having some pretty severe financial problems, but they were helped greatly by an incredibly generous bequest from the estate of B. Arthur. Who really had, I think, had done a fundraiser for them at one point, and then she obviously really, really believed in the cause, and she, I forget how much, it was a lot of money. So it probably wouldn't be overstating it to say that she saved the organization a few years back.
Wow.
But then they subsequently had some of their shelters not ruined, but damaged in Sandy. So now they lost a little ground there. So they really need the money. But you will love giving them the money to see this show, because it's always delightful. The guys are always, you know, hot and or really, really, really talented. This year we have, let's see, Callan Bergman from Silence the Musical, Julius C. Carter from Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark, Yurel Echezarreta from Matilda, Matthew Goodrich from The Nance. He's actually, I believe, the understudy for Johnny Orsini. Orion Griffiths, whom we have discussed, from Pippin, and Paul Hissang Miller from Mamma Mia. And the judges are Michael Yuri, Andrea Martin, and Billy Porter from Kinky Boots, and the host for all but one of the past events is back, Tova Feltshow. And this year it's at, in recent years, the show had been at Symphony Space, but now it's at the Kimmel Center at NYU, which is a very lovely theater. If some of you haven't been in it, you might want to experience that. Tomorrow, May 20th at 8 p.m.
And yet, just as Jerry Lewis says every year with the telethon, I hope this is the last year I see you, meaning that there'd be a cure for muscular dystrophy. Yeah. We are all looking forward to the day when the actual reason for this event is irrelevant.
Oh, yes.
In that parents will not even think twice about doing anything as remotely terrible as throwing their kids out of their home because of their sexuality.
Oh my God, yes. And just not to go too far off topic, but lately I've been reading about a terrible increase in gay bashings.
Isn't it awful? Isn't this incredible?
In Manhattan.
In Manhattan, yeah.
You know, and specifically, well, not specifically, but including Greenwich Village, and there was just, I'm reading now, someone was shot, I think last night, dead. Yeah. And it was obviously an anti-gay thing. So please be careful, whatever that means.
Sure. And yet, you know, as many hate crimes as occur here, ultimately, this movement is not going to be stopped. Anybody who is anti-gay is just finding himself more and more isolated as time goes on, because this is not a war that is going to be lost. It is not. And that's very clear to all of us. But it still needs to be clear to the rest of the nation. But it's so wonderful to see the now 12 states. That's a significant number. That's virtually one out of four.
Yep.
12 states having equal marriage rights. That's nifty. And for those of us who have been around a long time, we wouldn't have seen this coming. So this is really quite wonderful. And so despite these terrible setbacks, the movement continues.
By the way, I misspoke. I said the Kimmel Center. It's the
Skirball. Yeah.
Skirball Center at NYU.
So just very quickly before we wrap up here, am I remembering this correctly, that the Broadway Beauty Pageant, it was a little scuttlebutt. It used to be called Mr. Broadway.
Yes. Did you want to bring that up?
I did want to bring that up because I thought it was really ingracious of the person who
Stuart Lane
considers himself Mr. Broadway.
Stuart Lane.
Uh-huh.
You know, Ryan Davis and a handful of other folks who came up with this concept of Mr. Broadway, this beauty contest, were forced to change the name from Mr. Broadway because Stuart Lane calls himself Mr. Broadway, and he felt it was confusing to the audience, confusing to consumers that he was associated with this production.
He apparently copyrighted it.
Yeah.
Wow.
What a dick. I'm stunned.
Well, for the record, I'm not sure if it got to the point where he actually brought action. He threatened to.
Yeah.
Because he had copyrighted the name. But, I mean, I always step back and say, really?
Yeah.
The person who copyrighted the name Mr. Broadway for himself is Stuart
Lane. What have you done lately, Stuart Lane?
Wouldn't you think maybe it might be Hal Prince?
Yeah.
Wouldn't you think it might be, you know, I mean, but that's a typical case of the person overcompensating, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, every time this, you know, I guess this is the, you know, every year that this comes up, I think about this and I'm like, it was such an unfortunate thing for Stuart Lane to do. I mean, you embrace it and you engage it. You license the name for a dollar to this organization.
Yes, exactly.
To protect yourself. I don't know. Okay. I just get so annoyed with stupid people.
Yeah, I called them and tried to speak with him, and he wouldn't take my
call. Yeah. Well, you know, what have you done lately, Stuart Lane? Yeah, it's good seeing you on Broadway, Mr. Broadway. What a dick. A little bit upset about it, right?
I think you're right to be, you know.
All right, so I guess that wraps it up for this week. We're coming up to all sorts of things. Are you guys going to be able to sleep much in the next couple of weeks with all the different ceremonies and awards? And Peter, you have a book, and you have Theater World Awards and all the other stuff, and you're traveling, so we'll have to catch up again. Same bad time, same bad channel next week.
Look forward to it.
All right. So I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. That way you can subscribe, and there's a link there. Each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded for you, and you won't miss anything. You can also listen to us on Stitcher, which is an application for your iPhone, your Android device, your BlackBerry, and listen to us streaming. Or you can listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. If you want to contact Peter, Michael, or myself, go to BroadwayRadio.com. There's contact information for us there. Twitter, Facebook, phone numbers, things like that. And also there's links to some of the things that we've talked about today. So that way, if you want to follow up on anything we've talked about, there's more information there. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Videos This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. And don't you see, I want my life to be something more than long. Rivers belong where they can ramble. Eagles belong where they can fly. I've got to be where my spirit can run free. Gotta find my corner of the sky.